Hi, this is Tom O'Pennekin, and I played Hilo in Battlestar Galactica. You are listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Hi, this is Eugenia Stapira.
And this is Jerry Donaldson.
And welcome back to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
And in this podcast, what we're going to talk about?
Oh, we have some great things to talk about.
We're going to talk about cyborgs.
We're going to talk about robots.
And we're going to talk about androids.
And one in particular.
And we have a wonderful interview with Brent Spiner, one of the most famous androids in all of sci-fi, for you to listen to a little later. But, of course, you're going to have to listen to us first, so hang in there.
Well, there's really, as we mentioned, there are three types of mechanical beings, and that's your robot, your android, and your cyborg.
And varying kinds of technology. Some of them are full technology, some are part human along the way. And there have been many, many, many in science fiction.
Oh, too many to really, the more we start to think about it, the more we came up with.
The more research we did, the more we actually came up with along the way.
So we're going to fire some at you, but are we going to talk about the robots first?
No. Because, well, sort of. Is she a robot? Is she a cyborg? Is she an android?
Oh, okay. I know what you're getting at now.
Or is she the mother of all in sci-fi movies?
Anyway? Now, this is getting too cryptic for everybody who's listening, Jerry.
I suppose one of the earliest robot come androids that you can actually think about is the movie Metropolis, which is recently or is about to be re-released. They found 25 minutes of new footage that they didn't know existed in a little room somewhere.
And they've re-recorded the original score as well.
And remastered it with all the new digital stuff, so it looks great.
And even if you've never seen the movie, you will know the image of this robot from Metropolis because it's just something that's used all over the place in certain periods of time. And it's a very iconic type of vision of a robot.
It's going to be released very soon in Australia. When we record this podcast, it will actually be out and it's available through Mad Men Entertainment. So we really suggest that you go out and have a look for this DVD and buy it.
I'm sure it'd be worthwhile having a look at. I'm going to have a look at it. That's definitely.
Every sci-fi collector, if you want to put it, of television and or movies needs to have a copy of Metropolis in their collection because it's just iconic.
It is.
And her robot, Maria the robot, is just her image is all over the place and has inspired many, many, many creators of science fiction robots.
Well, C-3PO, for example, looks very much like her, but nice and gold.
And he doesn't have certain attributes that she does because she's a girl robot and he's a boy robot.
Well, that's true.
But she also has a touch of Doctor Who Cyberman.
Well, more so, I'd say
she's got the little heady thing.
She has got the little heady thing, but I would say she looks more like the Torchwood cyber lady that Yanto fell in love with.
Well, she was a sort of not quite a full cyber lady, cyber man person.
Not quite. But she
still had flesh.
She did still have flesh, but she sort of looked the same as the Metropolis
That's
robot
she
a little
had
bit.
Little girl bits, not boy bits. I think that comes along the way. I mean, if we give C-3PO girl bits, would he look more like Maria?
Well, it depends. He's in Spaceballs.
He does have girl bits.
He does have girl bits.
So there's another
Because
one.
Joan Rivers voices, remember, the C-3PO robot type
person
spoof, but she was a girl, not a boy. So she's got the girl bits this time.
Well, maybe we should go have a look at that picture again. Maybe Google it, see what happens and what comes up along the way.
But there's her, and then you go on to, you know, more famous robots like Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes.
Very famous one. No features hardly at all compared to normal robots that you see in other things.
Well, I think that was probably a lot about us, and I mean us humanity, being able to really envision what a robot would look like in terms of it. So we didn't want to give them too human-y features because they're where Maria had, of course, just looked like a human, a metal human along the way.
So we've got that. Then we've, of course, got Lost in Space and a very famous
robot
from there. And Robbie the robot from Forbidden Planet.
Yes, well, he was around before Lost in Space.
He was. He did turn up in Lost in Space.
And they look, yes, he did. And they look those reminded me of this of each other, those two robots.
They did, though Robbie had legs.
Okay.
Whereas Lost in Space, one had little wheels.
Treads.
And little conveyor belt type tread.
Like a tank.
Yes. And but I love both of them. I've always loved Robbie the Robot. I don't know what it was about Robbie the Robot, but in my mind as a child watching Forbidden Planet and then that sort of image of a robot keeping through, whenever you think of robot, it's always like Robbie the Robot. You have to have a Robbie the Robot.
Okay.
Well, that's for me. I have this thing about collecting robots.
Well, she does. I've been to her house. Believe me, she does along the way. I mean, of course, in terms of cyborgs, if we were looking at some of the most famous ones and getting back to Doctor Who, was the Daleks. They were actually cyborgs because there was a flesh portion of them, an ugly flesh portion,
mm-hmm.
inside, and they were a cyborg. So they were, you know, flesh assisted by mechanical.
Yes. And then, of course, you've got the Cybermen as well, which are even more...
The cyborg
type.
Which is why they're called Cybermen, I suppose.
Exactly.
And they've got the brain inside the mechanical body.
Yes. And then, of course, the $6 million Man is another very famous cyborg.
He's an extremely famous cyborg.
And at that time, a very handsome...
$6 million woman.
Yes, the bionic woman.
That's her in its many incarnations. Let's not forget the female form. Because I think in some ways representation of robots was mostly feminine in the early days.
That's true.
Because we got Maria and then there was also, oh, maybe they weren't female, maybe they were more androgynous, but the first robot, and this, you might have to Google this bit as well because we did and that's where we found it out, was was a 1920s play by Carol Capek, who actually invented the word robot in his Rossum's Universal Robots.
Well, I actually thought that it might have been Asimov, but it turns out that he coined the word robotics.
And
based on that and the study of robots, and then, of course, he developed the three laws of robots.
He did. You want to quote them?
Yes, I'll quote them. So number one
I think most people in science fiction would know the Asimovs because they are famous.
Well, they are. But, I mean, quickly, they're virtually that you can't hurt a human. You must obey orders by a human. And
such orders conflict the first law. And then the third law is you protect yourself unless it conflicts with the first and the second laws.
That's
of robotics
it.
And law. So it's long-winded and round.
It is. And that was brought out very strongly in like a film like RoboCop, where he was fighting all the time with those three laws. Because the corporation was trying to make him evil at some stage.
But I think that's because he was more of a cyborg than actually a robot. And in cyborg, he had a human brain.
Well, that's
and
true.
A human heart that was actually in there, where robots don't have a human brain or a human heart, and therefore they can't make those decisions for themselves. So the program actually had to have those stopgaps actually put into them, and that in itself is the difference between a robot and a cyborg.
Mm-hmm. And then the android part in there as well, because when you look at Blade Runner, when Harrison Ford didn't know that he was an android, so there's that whole humanity sort of thing and coming through too. So it's a very fine line there.
Well, it can be, and I mean that was also something that happened in Star Trek with Data's character.
Yeah.
Because he went out and found his mother, and I've got my little fingers up going wiggle, 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 like bunny ears and both, putting in its quote. And what he actually found out and didn't tell her was that she was an android that was actually created by Dr. Soong as well. And she was supposed to be unwell. And Dr. Soong even created her to the point where all her medical details actually transmitted as being a human body. So she was totally unaware of it and she was able to age and her hair was grey and so on. So, yes, from Blade Runner to Star Trek, there is this android that actually could live as a person.
Mm. And that was seeking humanity too. You know, that one of the very first thing in the very first episode of Star Trek in Encounter at Farpoint, there's the scene where Riker goes looking for Data, and that's the first time he meets him in the hologram forest. And Data is trying to whistle, and learn how to whistle. And he sort of talks, there's a dialogue between him and Riker about the fact that he would give up being the smartest person on Earth, because he knows he's the smartest in Starfleet, to be human. And Riker goes,
Pinocchio,
yeah.
But Pinocchio was a wooden toy. It wasn't a robot per se.
It wasn't, but it was still a non-human trying to become a human.
But I don't think that's necessarily so in lots of robot things. There are robots who are quite happy to be robots or cyborgs or automatons and that. And cyborgs, after they're actually cyborgs, become the Cybermen, don't want to revert back.
Because no, but then you look at something like Bicentennial Man, which was the Robin Williams film. That was, again, that robot wanting, or that android wanting, a human life.
But I think that's probably the psychological effect of human beings not being able to consider what it would be like not to have a conscience or not to have something along those lines. And I think it's very hard for humans to turn around and go, I can't be this unemotional. It wouldn't work. I have to be in love. I have to, you know, feel happiness. I have to feel all those things. Where obviously as a robot or a cyborg, I mean, even Data didn't have feelings. They were given to him later on, and they were artificial feelings along the way in terms of reaction.
Even though he was fully functional.
Even though he's fully functional. And like lots of robotic things, I'm sure will be fully. In fact, there are some out there already. I mean, if you go look around the world, I'm not going to tell you where to go. I've seen the odd occasional TV show. And that's actually, in terms of robotics, I think is heading in some way as a companion to a lot of people, which is what iRobot was all about. It was the bit, he was a companion to a family, and therefore over the many years that he was a companion to this family.
You mean Bicentennial Man?
Well, iRobot is the book that Bicentennial Man is based on.
And I thought iRobot 2 was against the robot laws and started killing people. Isn't that the Will Smith
When you're actually version? Talking about Asimov's whole series of books, there are iRobot, the TV series or the movie that Will Smith won, was actually a compilation of bits of lots of short stories that he wrote in. And one of the I was an avid Asimov reader when I was younger, and one of his characters, Susan, and I can't remember her surname, she was a robot psychologist, and there were different things where robots did different things. So they took bits out of them and made a whole movie out of it. So,
right, okay.
So it doesn't really give you the real Isaac Asimov. You know, it's not real as in it's not the stories he actually wrote. It's many parts of many bits.
Mm-hmm.
So iRobot, although he's a sort of kit robot, isn't really Asimov's robot, I don't think.
I don't know if he was that cute.
Well, he had blue eyes, didn't he? I remember this blue and white phase.
But there's still other robots that we can talk about, like Marvin from The Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy.
I am with a brain the size of a planet, and they want me to open the door.
That's it. So you've got the TV version, and then you've got the movie version.
You do. The TV version, if you haven't seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is a better Marvin than the one that you see.
Even with, what's his name?
Saifoy Beeblebrox, no?
No. Even with voicing Marvin was Snape.
Was it? In the movie? Oh, in the movie. I'm sorry, that's one of those movies that should have not even made it to DVD. Unfortunately, sometimes stories that come from one side of the world don't actually translate terribly well to the other side of the world and vice versa.
True.
And I think sometimes we should leave well enough alone. You know, it was one of those kind of movies. But now, never mind.
Another very famous robot android is Yul Brynner's Westworld robot. That was quite a sensation in the 70s when that hit the screens. Because, of course, it was a society where people could have every pleasure that they wanted that was made up with robots. And, of course, the robots suddenly went rogue.
See, I never watched it because it's a Western.
Yeah, well, I loved it because it was a Western. It was very well written, a very good story, though the sequel to it I don't think worked as well. But certainly that first one, because it was the first time you saw on screen that I can remember, and I guess I saw it when I was sort of a teenager. Thing I remember, is his face falling off and seeing his eyes popping out.
I do remember that somewhere. It was probably in a TV, the shorts for an upcoming movie or something like that. But
yeah. Not only that, it's appeared in every single sci-fi book that you can imagine probably. That is a compilation of movies.
Probably, but unfortunately it's not something I've seen.
And then we talked about before, you know, a couple of famous robots, droids, is R2-D2 and C-3PO. And
I wanted R2-D2.
Oh, didn't everybody?
I wanted him to come live with me, and I wanted him to just help me around the house and everything and do stuff.
You know, and going to places like Supernova and Armageddon where the...
Somebody makes them.
When they've got the R2-D2. The real one. It doesn't matter. The real one. I have to have my photo taken with one every single time.
It's not out of pose. We want a real one, not a pretend one. But, and one of the other one I wanted to take on was Johnny Five.
Oh, he was so cute.
He's so cute. His little wheels, his eyes.
I'm alive. I'm number five.
That's it. I'm alive. So that was really cute. I mean, in terms of, so there's been killer robots. There's been cute robots. There's been strange and weird robots.
And, of course, we've got K-9, the robot.
He's a robot dog.
He is a robot dog.
You've heard him.
You have.
Before.
And if you haven't, go back and listen to him.
He's in an earlier podcast. But I suppose in some of the things we've been mostly talking about Western robots, like from either the UK, US, and the variations yes. in between. But, of course, there was Mechagodzilla.
Oh, look, there were so many robots from the Asian culture, from the early sci-fi works that they did, that, yeah, there's so many that really bad ones.
I used to love Godzilla in any form. I mean, he was good. I liked him. Even when he was bad, I liked him. He was good because he never actually made the same noise at the same time as he actually did things. He was very clever.
He was very clever. There are just so many. Look, you go and have a look on Google. You can't, you know, you run out of time trying to, just saw one that we haven't talked about, and that's Terminator.
Oh, yeah, those robots. They were interesting.
They
were.
Well,
they're not. They're androids.
They're androids. Yeah, well, yeah, they're androids. They're androids.
Except the one that could melt and turn into things. Like, he wasn't really. What was he?
Well, he was.
It was a melty thing.
It was a mechanoid.
I don't know.
Meltanoid.
A meltanoid? Because he didn't actually have any working parts, the same way as the Terminator, Arnie's character. Because you could see that he was actually a construction of a, you know, infrastructure underneath
yes.
skin. Where the melty one, is it John Patrick?
Yes.
Who played that character? His character was very much a, like,
molten, almost liquid mercury type
that
thing
sort that of
could
mercurial
take a
thing
shape.
That actually could take any shape, as was the girl Terminator in the next. She still had that kind of feature too. So I don't know what you call them.
I don't know. That we have to find a new word for them.
Are they a robot?
Well.
As she said, a meltanoid?
A meltanoid. A liquidoid?
Meltanoid sounds better, doesn't it? I like meltanoid. I like that one.
So we've got Data now to listen to, or Brent Spiner, I should say.
Brent Spiner, who's a very funny man. And he's got a new show.
Yes, he has.
And the name of that show...
has something to do with Hill.
He actually plays himself in the show, and it's a web series, and it's called Brent Spiner's Fresh Hell. And you'll be able to catch Brent Spiner's Fresh Hell on YouTube. If you go to YouTube, you'll be able to catch Brent Spiner's Fresh Hell, and it's about Brent Spiner being Brent Spiner. And it's really quite funny.
And we have to thank again Scotty Liston from First Contact Conventions for allowing us to have the opportunity to speak to Brent.
And if you go to our website, genews-easing.com, you'll be able to find links to First Contact Conventions and see what's coming up in the future.
Enough from us.
Let's
go with Brent.
I love this town.
It's a good.
I had no idea it was so nice. I'd really like to come back for
a holiday time.
Well, yeah. No, I mean for like the rest of my life.
Really?
Oh, really?
Well, not the rest of my life, but I'd like to stay a month. I'd like to come and do a play. Do you know anybody who could hook me up to that? I've never been to Adelaide. It's a smaller town than this, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Do you have refrigeration there yet?
We have.
You were put up to say that, weren't you?
I wasn't. I came up with that all my own.
Ethan didn't come up with that?
No, no. I'm done.
You're done? You're done?
Yeah. Oh, we're not finished yet?
So you're only prepared to answer yes or no?
Well, or just yes.
Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we can ask you.
You want me to hold this?
Thank you.
Okay, who am I going to sing?
Please.
Good evening, please. Ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the show. I have never met you before in my life, have I? Okay. Let's begin. I'm not. I need inspiration.
Interaction. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, start off with Star Trek. Were you a Star Trek fan?
No, don't do that.
Were you a Star Trek fan before you?
Got old.
Were you a fan before you auditioned?
Well, let me just say this. I don't know what you mean by fan. Did I watch the show? Is that a fan?
That's a star.
Yeah. No. Let me say this. I probably saw all the original series at some point in time in my youth. I think it came on the air when I was 3 months old, and I started watching it then, and I didn't really understand it. But then years later, when I watched it again, I still didn't understand it. But I did watch all of them. So I guess I was a fan, right?
Yeah.
And music is obviously a passion for you. When did that begin?
When did music begin?
Because
I was going to say the first music was probably
a million years ago.
Yeah.
Drum, in fact, was the first musical instrument. But that's
a drum was the first musical instrument. See there, and I thought it was the harmonica. I play a very very poor guitar, and I play a really good voice. But I started doing music when I was in high school. I had an amazing high school teacher who kind of trained us to do everything we could possibly do. I mean, we did Shakespeare, we did Moliere, we did contemporary stuff, we did musicals, we did everything you could possibly do so that we'd be prepared, you know, if and when we ever had a professional career, which, of course, only I did. But, actually, I come from a class of people who are very illustrious, actually. Dennis and Randy Quaid both were in my class. Randy's, of course, notorious now, but he's a...
Are they quoting you?
Yeah, he's in Canada. He's in Vancouver. They apparently are going for refugee status in Vancouver. Seriously. But he's a hell of a talent, and pardon me for using the word talent. He's a great talent, and it's a sad thing that he's going through whatever is happening. But they were in my class, and a wonderful director named Tommy Schlamme, who created the West Wing with Aaron Sorkin, right, was in my high school drama class, and it was a great group. That's where music began for me. I think I got all the way back there, didn't I? Yeah, that's part of my genius. And I say that...
with sincerity?
Well, humility. Yeah. But
Star Trek, like all good science fiction, deals with a lot of moral issues and presents them in a way that doesn't offend people.
Correct.
If you had the opportunity to write an episode of a sci-fi show, what would you choose to write it about?
I would somehow make it, because you're right, I think the best of sci-fi comments on our time from another place, so that it's not quite as heavy-handed. I would deal somehow with the issue of gun control, and I would say all guns would be banished from the planets and the Earth and everywhere, because there really is no need for them. I know when I say things like that, people... attack big time.
Not so much in Australia, because we have such strict gun.
Oh, do you have gun control here?
Very strict. Yeah, very tight. Very strict.
Well, and is there much gun violence in Australia? No. You see, that's the thing, is people, the big thing they say in America
people
is...
people don't die from people breaking into their houses right. any more than they would if we had guns.
Well, that's what they say. Well, if we didn't have guns, only the bad guys would have them. But how about nobody has them? How about we even the score and... nobody manufactures them anymore, because they're an archaic device. We don't need to, explode people with firearms. It's crazy. And somebody's been locked out. Let me just hang on.
Come on in.
It's just insane. But you know what? The problem is in terms of science fiction. I don't think I've ever seen a science fiction show of any kind that didn't have blasters and phasers and, you know, yes, we could put them on stun.
Yep. Yeah.
But we're still blowing people out of the sky in Star Trek, and we're still, you know, there's this illusion that Star Trek is somehow morally correct in every way, but it really isn't. You know, it's still, we're at wars, we're blowing people away, we're exploding ships with thousands of people in them. What is that about? I don't get that. It really is, unfortunately, an illusion. You know, I mean, Gene Roddenberry, God bless him, was a policeman, and he knew what it was to carry a firearm. And when he created Star Trek, his whole idea was wagon train to the stars. That's what he said. And wagon train was the old West,
and they carried guns.
And they carried guns, and so we all carried guns on Star Trek. And I think it would have been really great if they had done away with that and sort of tried to deal with people without resorting to violence.
Yeah.
But hey,
I think his tip to the nod of that was the Vulcan, you know, this squeezing pinch,
yes,
thing to try to
exactly
move away from the,
well,
gun.
Would that we had all learned the Vulcan pinch. I mean, I knew it, but not everyone, you know, they didn't teach it to, well, for good reason they didn't teach it to Dorn, but he'd be out of control pinching everybody all the time if he didn't get his way. But that's the kind of guy he is.
What would you have done had you not been a Brent Spiner entertainer?
Good question. Brent Spiner prisoner. Brent Spiner master thief. I don't know. My family was in business. They had a container business in Houston, Texas, where I'm from. And that was always an option for me. I mean, they wanted me to be in the business. My brother was in the business. My mother was in the business. My aunts, my uncles, everybody. And it was a container distribution business. But I really didn't get interested in business at all until I started to make some money. And it became sort of incumbent upon me not to be irresponsible and to figure out what that was all about. But I don't know. I have no idea, because I wanted to be an actor from a really early age. And so I never really, you know, thought about it. Now I look at it and I go, what could I have done that would have... I mean, there's so many interesting things to do in the world now, with computers and internet and communication. And I think it would have had to be in some kind of form of communication.
Was the set different once Gene Roddenberry wasn't there anymore? Did it change in the way things happen, or had he set a precedence that carried on?
Well, you know, to be honest, the set didn't change at all, because Gene was hardly ever there. He was, you know, he was the first half of the first year he was most involved, and then less and less as time went on. He really handed it over to Rick very early, and Rick really did, by the way, try to always do well by Gene. I mean, I know a lot of fans have problems with Rick, and I don't know what that's about, really, because there wouldn't be 600 and some odd episodes of Star Trek if it wasn't for Rick Berman. But Rick really did always. We were much more mercenary than Rick was where the material was concerned. We wanted to change things and move it and break windows and doors and walls, and Rick always said, that's not what Gene would have done here. That's not Gene's vision. And so really it stayed close to it because of Rick. As far as what you asked, you know, Gene only visited the set now and then. He watched and taught and gave notes on all the episodes, but he really wasn't there much when we were there.
A lot of the actors that I've seen over the years always say, when they're asked about a specific episode, like, what's your favourite episode, they all say, look, we did so many, it's kind of hard to remember.
Right.
Is there anything that stands out for you in terms of the episodes?
Not really. I mean, for me, again, it's the same answer. It's like we did one long episode that lasted for 7 years. And you know, I just would get a script, and every night we'd work for 16 hours, and I'd go home and learn my lines for the next day. And they didn't really change that much. The only big difference is if I had days off. But
How hard was it to back up for 7 years doing that?
It was tough. Hard. It really was. It was the movies.
About 10 years, really.
At least, yeah. And it was hard work. It really was. I know that sounds absurd, and it wasn't hard work compared to real hard work. But
long work.
It was long work, and you had to be good for it. You know, I'm of a mind as an actor that the least you can do is know your lines and be on time. And sometimes that's the most you can do. But you've got to at least do that. And I had really difficult dialogue on that show.
Yeah.
And after doing a 16-hour day in that makeup and those contacts, I was exhausted. And I'd go home at night ready to go to bed, and I'd open the script and look at what I had to do the next day, and my stomach would turn over. I would think, there's no way I can learn this tonight. I'm too tired. And somehow it always happened. And but I had a rule with myself that I would not go to sleep unless I could say every word all the way through every speech without messing it up, so I'd know I could do it. And but it was difficult.
Were there any nights where you never got to sleep?
No, I always went to sleep. But there were nights where I had 4 hours of sleep because they had what they called, they have what the union requires a 12-hour turnaround. But they have what they call a forced call, where they can bring you in 9 hours. They have to pay you extra. But 9 hours from wrap time, it would take me an hour and a half to get my makeup off. Then I'd have to drive home. Then I'd have to have some dinner. And then I'd have to sit down and start learning my... and take a shower and get the rest of the makeup off. And then I'd have to start learning the lines. And by the time I hit the bed, I would have maybe 3-4 hours. But I always had this thought that it was a means to an end. I knew it's worth it. Just keep going. I know you can do it, and eventually it'll all be worth it. And it was.
What projects are you working on at the moment?
Well, I would tell you, but then of course
you'd have to kill us.
Yeah, I have to kill all of you.
Without a gun.
Even if I told you, yes, without a gun.
I have to go now.
Do you? Yeah, okay, yeah. Mark. Nice to see you. Actually, you know what? I've got, like most other actors, you have a certain amount of luck, because luck is everything.
Yes.
And eventually the luck dries out, or it does for a time. It may come back again. But when the luck dries out, it's then up to you to sort of be inventive.
Yes.
And
like Shatner.
Well, all right. Bill has had a nice roller coaster ride, but I'd love a roller coaster ride like he's had, because he really has had a lot of ups, and a few downs, but mostly ups. But so I'm working on different things that I'm, I did my CD and that took a long time, and I'm working on several other things.
Have you got any thoughts about doing another CD?
No, I don't think I'll do another one. I feel like I've done it. I mean, I'm not really I can sing, but I'm not. I'm an actor first and a writer, and then I sing. So I do have a nightclub act that I've been working on.
It's Adelaide Friends, perfect place to bring it.
Is it though? But yes, it's just a club act.
Yeah, we have a cabaret section as well that's later in the year.
Well, that's what it is. It's a cabaret.
And then there's the Melbourne Comedy Festival, which is a cabaret type thing.
I did a half hour of it in Vegas.
2009?
Yeah, but now it's an hour and 20 minutes long. But they wouldn't pay me, though. I have to have big money if I'm going to show up. I mean, I'm not talking, I need thousands in order to show up. And then I need all my expenses paid as well. Do they do that at the Fringe?
Sometimes. Depends on the quality of the act.
Oh, it's excellent. It really is. Was that what Sting was here for? Was he part of the Fringe?
He was just
he's a new talent.
Yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
He's brought under the stars.
Yeah, let me ask you about Sting. Do you think he is... do you think he's very taken with himself? I don't know. I think Sting is the most humble creature, isn't he?
Entertainers are very taken with themselves?
Well, they better be, because often no one else is. And,
you're adored.
Well, of course I am, but of course. But, really, by the way, if actors ask me, I tell them, look, you are going to face so much rejection and humiliation. You better not question yourself, because everyone else is going to, so you better be very certain about your worth. Sting is very certain about his work. Yeah, and he's great.
Yes. Yeah. So was that something you had to face as a young actor then?
Still, believe me.
But you learn things as you get older, I suppose.
Well, you don't take it as seriously. Yeah. You know, I walk out of an audition now, and I still have to audition, by the way, and I walk out of an audition, and if they don't cast me, I think, oh, poor them. You know, really, I really do. I go, oh, gosh, they could have had me, and now they've done this, you know. But
were you surprised that Threshold was cut off in the first season?
Because
that seemed to be really developing quite a good storyline.
That was
going to
be such a great show. Mm. I knew what they had going for the next season and the next season. They had it all planned out, and it was really exciting. And CBS just blew it because they, I'm told Les Moonves, who runs CBS, hates sci-fi. And he greenlit that show and didn't even know it was sci-fi. And he saw a trailer for it on television, and he turned to his wife and he said, "What is this?" She said, "You greenlit this. This is your show. It's on your network." And he said, "Get this off the air." And we were gone.
Is that sci-fi in general in America? Is it classed that way?
Not anymore, but only on CBS.
Brandon's had a couple of misses with shows like that, Threshold and Flash Forward. And
I'm
kind of hoping his new one with Spielberg takes off.
I think it's he's got a better shot.
Yeah.
Because they're very loath to say to Spielberg, "We're taking your
taking
show
you
off the air." Yeah, no.
Has television become too commercial? Like, if it's not a hit in 5 seconds, off the air?
Yeah, I think so. But at the same time, I think television has become better than features.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an odd thing, you know. I mean, obviously the best television is on cable. I mean, pay cable or free cable, too. But HBO, Showtime, TNT, A&E, I mean, all of it. I mean, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, that's better TV than you're getting
True
when
Blood.
You go to the movie theater.
Absolutely.
True Blood, Boardwalk Empire, fantastic. And you go to the theater, you get bubblegum. You know, it's not very little serious filmmaking going on. And if there is, it's not celebrated.
Yep.
And so you get better stuff on TV. Unfortunately, a lot of the good stuff gets yanked really fast on network. Not so much in cable. They'll give you a shot. They'll give you time to develop it.
And is that one of the banes of the actor's life these days? You think you've got something and then it's...
And then it's gone.
Yes.
Yeah. Sure. Because it's rare that you get something, period.
Yep.
As a public figure, and we sort of approached on this a little bit last night when we were talking about Twitter, you've got an issue where people think they know you because they've heard you in interviews, they see you on TV every week. How difficult is it to deal with people who react that way?
Who want you to be...
Their friend?
Well, they want you to be your character, right? They don't want you to be who you are. They're disappointed when they find out you're not who they thought you were. And that's so ridiculous because who they thought you were was a complete illusion, their own illusion. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with disappointing people on that level.
Yep.
I feel like I can only be me, and if they don't like it, well, that's fine. You know, you can't like everybody. I mean, everybody should like me, but
of course we do.
Yeah, of course.
What advice would you give to people who are following celebrities such as yourself on Twitter or whatever? What advice would you give them? How would you suggest that they...
Well, I would say don't take me so seriously, and please don't take yourself so seriously. You know, it's not important. It's Twitter, for God's sakes. It's 140 characters. It's like, you know, who cares? Well, I wouldn't say those three words that Shatner once spoke. But I would say... You know, giving people a break, you know. I mean, everybody's not the same.
Now, you did a bit of writing with Nemesis.
Yes.
Is writing something that you want to pursue, or was that just something you tried? Or
no, I write stuff all the time. It just doesn't get produced. But I like to write, so I probably will always do that. I look at Twitter as writing in a way. I mean, I think of it as...
It's creative.
It's creative. It's a creative outlet. And that's something else that people don't like, is that I use it as a creative outlet, that I use the audience as an audience. But that's what they are. I mean, I don't know what they want to be. It's like... you know, best friends with 1,300,000 people? How do you do that?
You can't.
No.
And we use it as a tour de la fête. People make smart comments, you have a giggle, you move on.
That's what it's for. Yeah. It's to amuse. And some people use it for political reasons and things like that. But for me, it's to amuse. Yeah.
Got to ask you.
Yes.
We just touched on it. Star Trek Nemesis.
Yes.
You obviously played a fairly important role in the creative process as well as being in the film.
Yeah.
What were your feelings post the release of Nemesis in terms of a swan song for the crew?
Well, let me say this. We knew that that was going to be the last film. I mean, there was always the possibility that they would say, oh, well, okay, do another one if the fans had come. But the fact is, the fans didn't go to the movie. It wasn't that they went and didn't like it. They didn't go. Some did, obviously, or it would have made zero money. Yeah, of course. And some people went more than once. Right. But it didn't open. And we had always opened big. The opening of a movie of a Star Trek movie was all about the fans coming. And that movie didn't open. So clearly they didn't come. We were up against things like a Harry Potter movie and a James Bond movie, and it was a ridiculous,
Lord of the Rings.
It was a terrible
well.
Time to open the film, and it was the genius of somebody at Paramount to decide to open us at Christmas instead of Thanksgiving, where we usually open.
Yep.
That being said, clearly a lot of people didn't like the film, and mostly didn't like what happened with Data in the movie. But I have to say, I didn't have a problem with it because, again, we knew it was our last film. We thought, well, let's do something dramatic to end the film. All the other characters were killed too, by the way, but they were killed by Paramount. You haven't seen anybody else. You know, Data was killed in the film, but you haven't seen any of the others again either. You know, so it's not like we were all coming back for another movie except for Data. No one was coming back. So we thought, let's do something, you know, dramatically and emotionally fulfilling. And people didn't like it. What can I say?
So who put that little ending in where before got you, your memories?
Well,
you
we did that just in case? Just in case, yeah. And actually, I remember the day we shot that, Patrick watched it on the video, and he came back and he said, we're coming back. I know we're going to come back. And but we didn't. So
how was it going to Enterprise and working with them for that time that you worked with them?
Well, it was fun. And two of the three episodes I did, one was directed by David Livingston, who was production supervisor on our show. And the other one was LeVar.
Yeah.
So it wasn't really that strange for me. And all the crew was the same, the same camera operators and, you know, gaffers. And yeah, it was coming home.
Yeah. In the last season of Enterprise, obviously Manny Cato was coming in with some incredible storylines.
Yeah, I loved his work, yeah.
And it was just finished. I mean, it was like a new series just starting all over again.
I thought that was a really stupid thing for them to end the show at that point because it was just starting to get good.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really was. That last season, they really started to do some good stuff.
Explaining everything?
Yeah.
Well, Brandon and Manny do a really good piece when they go to Vegas, which is they get up on stage and they answer questions from the fans about what they were talking about in terms of season 5. So
yeah, they were really creative, those guys, and I think Paramount made a huge mistake in canceling it. I think they canceled it prematurely.
No, you have to wrap up, don't you?
I think
you just got the wind up before.
I did, yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much.
It's a
pleasure.
This is Star Trek.
So, Eugenia, that was Brent.
That was indeed.
And we really had a great time meeting him in Melbourne, Australia. He seemed to enjoy the day with all these people, you know, hanging out on his every word. He's very entertaining.
He is very entertaining. And the one thing I found about him is that he didn't just have his bit on stage and then go away. He did mingle amongst people and was in the dealer's room and talking to people in the dealer's room. And so he wasn't sort of one of these ones that you don't ever see ever again.
He was very affable and very friendly and interested in what was going around him.
Mm. And very quick with a sarcastic joke.
He's a quip. He's a good quip. And you'll see that in Fresh Hell if you go and have a look at it. So I really recommend that you do find that.
And again, go to firstcontactconventions.com.au if you're in Australia, because if you love Star Trek and some of the other sci-fi shows, you'll enjoy going to those conventions. That's very true.
And also they have a few horror coming up. So I'm looking forward to some of those, because some of those have been sci-fi too. The what is it, Freddy Krueger?
Yes, he's been in V.
Who was one of my favourite characters in V. So.
And Tony Todd, who's also been in Star Trek.
He was a Klingon.
Well, he was also the older Jake Sisko in Deep Space Nine. And he was Hirogen as well.
In Voyager.
He's in lots of things. So again, it's time for me to say goodbye, and I'm Eugenia.
Are you?
Yeah, I am. Because I'm not Jerry.
No, because we've got a different accent. Although I'm Australian now.
Da 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 da.
Yeah, they made me sing that. That's a little inside joke. Many years you live in a country, you just finally get around to actually being.
Only because she wants to leave the country for a holiday.
I had to get a passport and all that kind of stuff. So, but never mind. I am now.
So goodbye from Aussie Jerry.
And goodbye from me. All right, night.
Bye-bye. 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 Bye-bye.